Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. The cover story of National Geographic this month is a beauty, thinking like a dolphin, understanding one of the smartest creatures on Earth. It's the first of a three-part lengthy series and so interesting. And this month's, it's time for conversation, breaking the communication barrier between dolphins and humans. And the author of the piece is with us the first half of this show. Next month, the story will be Born to be Wild. Thousands of dolphins have been taken captive to perform in shows at marine parks. Now some are being taught how to go home again. We'll be welcoming phone calls all hour long. I'm sure many of you share our fascination with dolphins. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour, I love this description, says they're a kind of alien. They are a kind of alien intelligence sharing our planet. Watching them may be the closest we'll ever come to encountering E.T. To get us in the mood, this is the sound of a dolphin. Joshua Foer is our guest, author of the National Geographic May cover story, Thinking Like a Dolphin. His best-selling first book, Moonwalking with Einstein, about improving memory and mental capacity, is published in 33 languages. His writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, Slate, Outside, The New York Times, and other publications. Joshua, thank you so much for being with us. What a beautiful story and gorgeous pictures of dolphins. Thank you for doing this work.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. I love this sentence, and I read it, but let me ask you what you mean by this. They are a kind of alien intelligence, so watching them may be the closest we'll come to encountering E.T. Is that what you thought when you watched them?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, you know, so it's funny. When we think about intelligence and intelligent animals, we think about primates, chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and when you look at an animal like that, you can see some semblance of ourselves, something that feels familiar in the things that they do that feel intelligent. When you look at a dolphin and what it's capable of, you know, we're talking about a species that has a very, very long and different evolutionary history from primates. And they've got really large brains. In fact, brain to body size, they are the second brainiest animals on the planet, second only to us, and in fact, larger brain relative to body size than chimpanzees. But it's a brain that's evolved along a very different trajectory than the primate brain. And so it's a different kind of intelligence. And when I asked the question to one of the world's leading dolphin cognition researchers, a guy called Stan Kujai, I said, you know, how smart are dolphins? And he said, that's not the right question. The question is not how smart are dolphins, but how are dolphins smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're intelligent in very, very different ways than we are.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about that lineage, this is a long time ago that cetaceans, such as dolphins, split off from the rest of the mammal lineage about 55 million years ago. That's a long time.
It is, and if you were to go back and you know, trace the most recent common ancestor between, me and Bobo the chimpanzee, we would arrive at a great-great-great-great-great-so-on grandmother who lived somewhere on the order of 6 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to do that with, me and Shamu, we would have to go back somewhere on the order of 95 million years before we had a common ancestor. It's been
mm-hmm.
about 55 million years since dolphins or cetaceans split off from the rest of the mammal lineage.
So when you talk to people for the story and ask the question, why are their brains so large, what did you hear?
Well, it's actually something of a mystery. Why, of all the creatures in the ocean, should this particular creature have developed such a large brain and such extraordinary capabilities? And, you know, this is just a matter of some disagreement, but, you know, there is, it's thought of perhaps a kind of ecological evolutionary explanation for this. And to explain it, you have to go back and look at the fossil record. So somewhere on the order, if you go back, say, 34, 35 million years, there are dolphins or dolphin-like creatures, their ancestors swimming in the oceans, but they look very different from the dolphins that we know today. And I should say, dolphins, there's not one species of dolphins. There's a whole family of species of dolphins, and that family includes everything from gigantic orcas, killer whales that are upwards of 30 feet long, to much smaller creatures that are closer to the length of a human. And 34 million years ago, dolphins looked like these big, hulking, predatory creatures with large teeth. And around that time, something happened in the oceans. The oceans started to cool. There was a period of significant oceanic cooling. And that changed the environment for those dolphins and opened up new ecological niches that these creatures were able to explore. And it changed how they hunted, how they interacted with each other. Around this time, we start to see evidence in their ear bones of the beginnings of echolocation, the ability to effectively see with sound by bouncing sonar off of other objects in the ocean. We see their teeth shrink, their bodies shrink, and it seems to have happened that around that time, these animals went from being hunters of big fish to collective social hunters of many smaller fish. And so it was around that time, it's been hypothesized that they became more intelligent, more communicative, more social, and probably more intelligent.
And this this way that they can see with sound is pretty extraordinary. You write that they can tell the difference from quite a ways away between a piece of plastic or a piece of wood.
Yeah, and so you know when you think about a really different kind of intelligence, how do you even imagine what it is like to experience life as a dolphin?
I know.
So when you think about a chimpanzee, it feels like you can watch a chimp eating fruit or harassing an alpha male or whatever it is that they're doing. It feels like some sort of kind of diminished version of something that we know, or a familiar version of something we know. But to experience life as a dolphin, not only echolocating but living in, you know, floating in three dimensions, and probably most notably living in these really intense social groups, it's something very, very different from the kind of intelligence that we know.
Mm-hmm. You start the article by talking about these two dolphins, and they're performing essentially what we would say is tricks for us. They're being able to move in tandem, doing behavior, and they are told to do something that the trainer has not seen, and to do it in unison. And you say that there are two explanations of this. Either one is mimicking the other so quickly and so precisely that the apparent coordination is only an illusion, or when they whistle back and forth beneath the surface, they are literally discussing a plan. Why is it hard to determine if the second is what they're doing, discussing a plan?
Well, so let me just set the scene a little bit more for you, because this really is an amazing thing to witness. So basically, you've got these dolphins who've been trained to perform tricks at the set. You know, you flash a hand signal, and they know that that signal means jump up in the air and do a corkscrew, or blow a bubble, or walk backwards across the surface of the water. They've also taught these dolphins an abstract concept, which is if they make a certain hand signal, that means show me something that you haven't shown me yet today, haven't shown me during this training session. That's an incredibly abstract concept. That means, like, show me something innovative.
Right.
And they get that, and they do it. Now, they also have a hand signal, a different hand signal, which means when you show it in the presence of two dolphins, it means do the same thing together. So if you can show them that signal and blow a bubble, and they'll both blow the bubble together. Okay, that's pretty interesting. What they've done is they've combined these two hand signals. So the first signal is, whatever I'm about to show you, do it together. And then the second signal is, now go do something I haven't seen before. So what are these animals supposed to do with that? And what they do, and I watched it happen, they dip down beneath the surface, and they make some of those sounds that you were playing at the beginning of your program. They're jabbering back and forth about something, it would seem. And they emerge, and then they do something new together. So only two things could, there are only two possibilities to explain this. Either one, one of them is mimicking the other, very, very close succession so that it appears that they're doing this in sort of as a plan, or they're actually planning something down beneath the waves. And this researcher, Stan Kujai, who's been studying this behavior and hoping that this might be kind of a Rosetta Stone to help us understand what dolphin vocalization is all about, he figures, here we've got an observed behavior, and we've got a set of sounds. If we can figure out a pattern between the sounds that the dolphins are making beneath the ocean while they're apparently planning, and the behavior that they then go and perform, that might help open up this question of what are all of those sounds that those dolphins are making underneath the water all the time? What are those sounds about?
So how do we go about doing that, and is this going to be just a Herculean task?
Well, scientists have been interested in dolphin vocalizations for over half a century. And it's understandable why they would be interested in them. You know, dolphins are clearly very intelligent creatures. They've got these big brains. They're highly social. And they spend a lot of their energy and a lot of their time making noises. Why are they doing that? It doesn't make sense that they would just be, making all of these vocalizations for no good reason. The notion that they are communicating somehow is very compelling. Now, are they communicating in something that approximates a language? Maybe. That seems kind of far-fetched. But there must be some content to those communications. And yet, for the half century that the scientists have been trying to make sense of them, nobody has really made much progress. And so this is one of science's great remaining mysteries. What are dolphins doing with all of those sounds? Are they communicating? Is there something that is language-like in those communications? Mm.
And is it because our evolutionary paths are so different that our brains would be so different, and thus the comparison to E.T., they might be communicating, but in a language that is really foreign to us?
Well, you know, you would think you'd be able to find some sort of pattern, and that's what Kujai is looking for, and he's not the only one. Some sort of a pattern that might link these sounds with behavior. But you know, one of the challenges here is those sounds, and we heard a little snippet of this at the beginning. First of all, they span quite a wide range of frequencies. So it's only within the last 10 years or so that the technology has been available to even record, much less listen to, the highest frequency sounds that dolphins make. And then once you've collected all of this data, once you've recorded all of these sounds, what do you do with it? And it's only within roughly that same amount of time that we've started to have the data mining algorithms, the machine learning algorithms that have allowed us to start to even contemplate analyzing a vast database of dolphin sounds to try and make sense of it. So far, though, you have to look at the results and say, well, this is not looking very promising. Nothing has really been figured out yet.
You have to believe it's going to be figured out, though, don't you? Because it's obvious something's going on. And you even write about how, with members of their group, they seem to have different sounds, welcoming sounds, which are repeated for different dolphins. You know, hi Sam, or hi, George, or hi, Julia.
Well, yes. Now, that's really interesting. And that's also something that's only really come to light relatively recently. So we know that other species, vervet monkeys, prairie dogs, have the referential labeling, a kind of small vocabulary to refer to, for example, predators. You know, a vervet monkey will make a certain call if there's an eagle nearby so that he can alert other members of his community to the presence of a predator. What has never been observed in any other species is what they have found in dolphins, which is the existence of what they call signature whistles. And effectively, each dolphin has a unique whistle that refers to himself and that they use to greet each other with underwater. Like, hey, Jim, hey, Kathleen, hey, Josh. And it's a little whistle. Each one's got it. Each dolphin has its own. And so that's truly unique. Only us and dolphins have anything approaching names. And, you know, some scientists are a little bit hesitant to call them names, but as a journalist, I think I have enough leeway to say, yeah, these aren't names. I don't know what are.
Right. A dolphin alone, you write, is not really a dolphin. Being a dolphin means being embedded in a complex social network, even more so than with humans. What's the network?
Well, so this is also very interesting. One of the things that is special about dolphins, I tell the story of there was a, not that long ago, in 2013, there was a mass stranding in Australia. And what ends up happening in these mass strandings is, a sick dolphin starts moving in towards shore, and the rest of the pack will follow that dolphin, even if it means the end result is a kind of mass suicide. And in 2013 in Australia, the only way that scientists could avert one of these mass strandings was to kidnap a juvenile dolphin, take him out to sea, and let her distress calls draw the rest of the dolphins away from this collective suicide. They have an incredible sense of interconnection with other dolphins. Typically, with bottlenose dolphins, they form these alliances of two or three male dolphins will team up in a kind of long-term friendship way, where they will help each other to effectively corral female dolphins and protect female dolphins for themselves. But in addition to those alliances, they have what a researcher named Richard Connor, who studies dolphins in Shark Bay, Australia, has called second-order alliances. So sometimes these teams will team up with each other to steal other female dolphins. And he's even observed what he calls third-order alliances, where teams of teams will effectively go to battle with each other. And what's so interesting about this is that you might be on the same team with another dolphin one day and be on opposite teams from that dolphin another day. And, with primates, even with humans, we talk about, you're either with us or you're against us, right? You're either a friend or you're an enemy. That's not the case with the dolphins in Shark Bay, Australia. There's a kind of situational alliance formation. You have to keep track of what other dolphins are there, who's observing this, so that you know which team that you're playing for. And that's a lot to keep track of. And it's thought that might be part of the explanation for their large brains, these having to keep track of these complex social arrangements.
And some of those arrangements last for, 16 years, right?
They can last quite a while. And these signature whistle, these so-called names, dolphins can remember them for at least 20 years. So, yeah, we're talking about, long-lived animals that have long, complex lives.
And when you talk about an animal, a dolphin in distress, beaching himself or herself and others coming along to try and be of help or to show compassion is what it sounds like. So they must be capable of empathy.
Well, to a certain extent, we have to anthropomorphize to answer that question. But they do seem to have very, very intense, whether you want to call them emotional connections or something else, very intense connections with each other that last a very long time. And that's clearly an important part of what it means to be a dolphin.
Mm. Well, let's take a couple phone calls for you if we can. Joshua Foer is our guest. He's the author of the National Geographic May cover story, and it's absolutely fascinating, as you can tell just by listening to him, titled Thinking Like a Dolphin, Understanding One of the Smartest Creatures on Earth. This is the first of a three-part series that National Geographic is doing on dolphins. Next month, they will be looking at Born to be Wild, about captive dolphins and killer whales and that industry, and how somebody who has worked in both that industry and working to release these animals back to the sea will be with us to talk about how difficult that is. You have to teach them to hunt again, how to eat fish that are alive, how to stay alive in the ocean. Well, we have time for a few phone calls. I'm sure that many of you have looked at dolphins and you've read about them. They are absolutely fascinating creatures. If you have questions for Joshua or experiences that you've had with dolphins, because a lot of people have experiences with dolphins. They swim with them and they think they're spiritual animals. And if you have profound questions about why their brains are so big or if they can talk to each other and how we discover that, feel free to call them on in right now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well. And that's at K Dunn Show. And like us when you're on Facebook, actually, because we're almost at 5,000 people. I love Facebook. I know some people don't, but I really love it. I love to read your comments. So if you like us and help us reach 5,000, then we'll get chocolate. I mean, we'll get chocolate here. We can't get chocolate with you, but we'll get some chocolate. I promise. Scotty and KP, I promise. All right. We hope to start taking your calls in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joshua Four is our guest, and he is the author of the National Geographic cover story for May, Thinking Like a Dolphin. We're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we'll start our calls with Holly in New Berlin. Hi, Holly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, if dolphins, how do they communicate with other animals? Do they work together? And I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks. All right, Holly. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, what a great question. I mean, so they definitely work together. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about dolphins is not only do they work together, but different populations of dolphins in different areas work together in different ways. So, for example, off the coast of Patagonia, and we have an incredible photograph of this taken by Brian Scarry in this month's issue of National Geographic, dusky dolphins will cooperate by effectively herding anchovies into these neat spheres of anchovies, and then they take turns eating them. The picture that we've got in the magazine, it's like one of these, just unbelievable that he got this photo.
Yes.
You can also see a Magellanic penguin coming in and stealing away with one of these fish, and a bird flying down out of the sky to come grab some fish as well. So that's an example. In Florida Bay, dolphins will swim around in circles. So this is, you know, clearly something where they're cooperating. They'll swim around in circles and kick up curtains of mud around the mullet fish. So the mullet fish can't get out. They effectively feel like they're trapped. And the mullet fish will jump out of this curtain of mud and, you know, really right into the mouths of the waiting dolphins. And so this is interesting for two reasons. First of all, because of, you know, the obvious cooperation that's going on to make this hunting successful, but also because this is what you might call a cultural behavior. Right? This is something that is not inherent to to dolphin genetics. They engage in this kind of hunting. This is something that they learned and that got passed down over the generations. This is a way to hunt.
Thank you very much for the call. Ray from Milwaukee sends this email. I heard that dolphins are one of the few species who can recognize themselves in a mirror. Is that true? And also, are the Japanese still hunting dolphins?
It is true, and it's one of the things that has been pointed to as evidence of their intelligence. So, you know, humans obviously recognize ourselves in the mirrors, and other species do as well. Elephants, chimpanzees. If you're recognizing yourself in the mirror, that means you have a sense of yourself, and dolphins seem to have that.
Mm-hmm. They don't breathe automatically, you write, and they seem to sleep with only half their brains resting at a time, and their eyes operate independently of each other. How do they breathe?
It's something they have to will. I mean, when you're underneath the water, you obviously you have to decide to come up and only breathe when you are at the surface. Remember, dolphins are mammals, just like us. They've got lungs. They've got they don't breathe through gills the way fish do. They have to take their oxygen out of the air, not out of the water.
Mm-hmm. And is this true of us also? Because we have dreams when we sleep. Do we sleep with half our brains resting at a time, or all of it?
Boy, I think that when we sleep, we kind of shut down globally. Although I have to admit that's not something I'm an expert in.
Yeah. And their eyes operating. So when they're looking at somebody and getting all the hand signals to do all those amazing things they can do, they're seeing that out of one eye. Their eye focuses. One eye focuses on commands.
Well, I think the notion there that they can move their eyes independently, whereas, you know, for us, if I choose to look left, I look left with both my eyes. Right, I look right with both of my eyes. I think they've got more control over that than we do.
Hmm. So as you spent time, this must have been an incredible piece to write. It probably makes you want to just work with dolphins for the next few years, I would think. What questions and what miracles sort of came to mind as you watched them and as you wrote about them, Joshua?
Well, I have to say, one of the truly special reporting experiences I've had was on this story. I got to spend time with a researcher named Denise Herzing, who runs the largest wild dolphin research site, largest wild dolphin research project in the waters off the Bahamas. And that's a unique place to be with dolphins, because most places where dolphins live in the ocean do not have clear water, so it's, you know, you really can't see them.
Uh-huh.
Except very up close. Remember, these are animals that can move very fast. So it's hard to do underwater wild research, except in a few places in the world where the waters are clear enough to be able to be down there with them. But then there are places that have clear water that also have large quantities of sharks, where, you know, you might not want to be in the water for very long. What's really special about where Denise works, off the coast of the Bahamas, is that you have clear water that's relatively shark-free. And so she can spend hours upon hours having these really long encounters with a population of wild dolphins that she's been studying for 30 years.
Oh, goodness.
She knows not just these dolphins, but she knows their parents and their grandparents, and truly has watched these individuals grow up, become parents themselves. And that's magical. It's magical to be with, you know, it's a vast ocean out there. And every summer she goes out and she finds these same roughly 300 dolphins and has gotten to know them and to be a part of their lives. She's kind of like the Jane Goodall of dolphins.
Mm, that's great. And do you think that she's on the verge of making breakthroughs when it comes to communications? I know she's working with some sophisticated equipment and analysis, people who are analyzing their sounds.
Yeah, so what she's trying to do is, I mean, it's an incredible project, hugely ambitious, is it's very hard to do work in the wild with dolphins. Most cognitive work that goes on with dolphins happens in captivity, which has, you know, as Tim's going to talk about, I'm sure, comes with a whole host of ethical problems. What she does in the wild is she is trying to train a group of these dolphins to effectively communicate with her in an artificial language that she has invented. So she wears a little computer on her chest when she goes underwater that allows her to broadcast a set of sounds, dolphin whistles, that she is trying to associate with different objects in their environment, a rope, a scarf, pieces of sargassum, which is a kind of seaweed. And she's hoping that by using these items with these dolphins and making these sounds, that these dolphins will learn to associate this vocabulary of sounds with these objects, and that can become the basis for creating a more sophisticated artificial language in which she and these dolphins can exchange information.
Oh, fascinating.
Hugely ambitious, but, you know, it's promising research.
Mm. Joshua, thank you so much. It's just a fascinating article, and I share your absolute fascination with these marvelous creatures. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Joshua Foer, he's author of the cover story for the May National Geographic, Thinking Like a Dolphin, Understanding One of the Smartest Creatures on Earth. He's also the author of Moonwalking with Einstein, about improving memory and mental capacity, and has written for The New Yorker, Esquire, Slate, Outside, The New York Times, and many other publications. As I said, National Geographic is doing a three-part series on dolphins, and so you're getting a preview preview, a sneak preview of what next month they will be covering, and that is Born to be Wild. Thousands of dolphins have been taken captive to perform in shows at marine parks, as you know, and some are now being taught to go home again, and it's not an easy thing to do. Tim Zimmerman is with us now. Tim has written extensively about the captive dolphin and killer whale industry. He was associate producer of the documentary, many of you may have seen, Blackfish, and we thank you very much, Tim, for being with us. Good afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
So how extensive are the efforts to release dolphins back to the sea? Are there many of them or just a handful?
They're just a handful. The idea of releasing dolphins back to the sea, or a question of whether captive dolphins who have been in marine parks for a number of years can be released back into the ocean, is increasingly prominent because people, partly because of their increasing awareness of dolphin intelligence, as you and Josh discussed, have ethical questions about keeping dolphins in captivity. But the fact is there just aren't that many dolphins that marine parks are willing to give up or that become available to try to release back to the sea. So it's something that people hope can happen more frequently, but it's not happening very often right now.
Not willing to give up because they're big money makers for their operations, huh? Everybody wants to see these remarkable animals perform.
That's right. I mean, partly due to their intelligence, they're highly trainable. They're obviously very charismatic. And so they do make a lot of money for marine parks.
You tell the story of Jeff Foster, who for 14 years helped capture 24 killer whales for SeaWorld and other marine parks from waters off the U.S. and Iceland. He's also taken smaller dolphins and other animals, seals, to places for in captivity for display. But now he's doing the other side of this, isn't he? He's taking the animals in one place in releasing them to the wild and has to teach them how to live in an entirely different way. Tell me about him. He's an interesting character.
He's a fascinating character and a very interesting guy. He's in his late 50s now, and basically the first half of his working life he spent helping capture killer whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals for SeaWorld and other marine parks. And he did that because he thought that was the best way to learn about them. He was fascinated by them, and he also thought that in captivity, if you bring these animals in captivity, the public could learn about them and establish a connection with them. But over time, he became increasingly sensitive to the fact that he was separating calves from their families and that captivity was a very different environment for them. So he gave up capturing the animals and started to do more research and then became involved in the effort to free Keiko, who was the star of Free Willy, back into with the waters off Iceland. And then also, as I write in the story, was called by a nonprofit called Born Free, which took possession of two Turkish dolphins who were available to be returned to the ocean. And they hired Jeff Foster because he was the person who had the most knowledge about how to reverse the process of bringing a dolphin into captivity and training it to survive back in the wild.
Hmm. And when you say they became available to be returned, was there a demand for them to be returned?
Well, what happened was these were two dolphins. They're called Tom and Misha, two male dolphins. And basically they were in a very decrepit and sort of rudimentary swimming pool that had been built in a hill town in Turkey, a tourist town, and they were there to tow tourists around for $50 a shot. And there were a number of locals who became outraged by the fact that these two dolphins were living in this pool, which had inadequate filtration. And they basically boycotted the place and got a campaign going to shut it down. Tom and Misha were on the verge of death, probably. And so Born Free came in and took possession of the dolphins with the idea that they would try to release them back into the ocean as a way of proving the concept that you can teach dolphins who have been in captivity for so long what they need to know to survive in the wild again, because they thought that was a very important thing to show people as this debate about marine mammal captivity proceeds into the future.
You describe this as getting them off autopilot and thinking again, because they get used to just being thrown dead fish and life is pretty much taken care of for them. So even to be able to eat, if they're released, they have to learn how to eat again.
Yeah, and I mean, it's an amazing thing that, you know, once you really start thinking about it, it's very striking. I mean, the dolphins is a dolphin. It's physically the same animal that it was when it was in the ocean, but the environment is so completely different that the dolphin changes. They, as they say, as you say, they don't have to hunt for wild fish anymore. They just get fed frozen fish. They don't move around much except for in the show, so they lose their conditioning. And then what was most interesting to me was their orientation completely shifts from below the water, which is where they spend all their time in the wild and where all the action is, to above the water. In a marine park pool, there really is nothing below the water except for painted walls, and all the action is above the water. It's where the crowds are, it's where the noise is, it's where the trainers are who are feeding them fish and giving them signals. And so part of the challenge of preparing dolphins to go back into the ocean is you have to teach them to be interested in what's underneath the ocean again, and to be able to adapt to all the different animals and situations they will then find themselves
in
once they're back in the ocean.
So what happened to all of these dolphins that were released? Were they able to survive?
So it was very interesting. So there was Tom and Misha who were released in Turkey in 2012, and then there were three Korean dolphins who were released off South Korea in 2013. One of the interesting things that both these projects did was there had been releases previously in the past, but they were never very well documented or followed up with, and so any sightings of dolphins afterwards were purely anecdotal. And both of these projects wanted to confirm that how the dolphins did once they were back in the wild. Tom and Misha had satellite tags that lasted for about 6 months, and it was interesting. They had different personalities. Tom had adapted quite well to captivity. He'd gotten quite used to being with humans. He was comfortable with it. And Misha, who was probably older, never was quite used to it. And so after they were released, they stayed together for about 5 days, and then they split up, and Misha basically took off and was never seen again. Tom ended up hanging out on occasion off resort towns and swimming up to people in the ocean, and of course that wasn't a very good thing, because then people would start feeding him again, and he would become habituated to human company again. And eventually, actually, he was off one resort, and he was stealing fish out of the fishermen's nets. And they threatened to shoot him. And luckily, the project got word, Born Free got word that this was going on. And so Jeff Foster and a couple of his guys went out to Turkey, and they knew where he was because of the satellite tracker. And they went to recapture him. And one of the most interesting things to me was that they figured they would just hop in the water, they would show him some dead fish or what he was used to, and he would basically behave as he had in captivity. But when they got in the water with him, they realized two things. One, he had grown much larger out in the ocean, and the second was he had gone completely wild, and he had no interest in being recaptured, and it was a big battle to get him into a stretcher and to relocate him away from the fishermen.
Oh, that's fascinating. We welcome phone calls, and we're talking this half hour about a story that will appear in National Geographic next month, Born to be Wild. Thousands of dolphins have been taken captive to perform in shows at marine parks, but some are now being taught to go home again, that it's not always easy. It's not that you can never go home, but you have to learn how to go home sometimes. And our guest is Tim Zimmerman, who wrote the piece. He's written extensively about the captive dolphin and the killer whale industry. He's associate producer and co-writer of the documentary film Blackfish. He is a former senior editor and diplomatic correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and author of The Race. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. An obvious question for you would be, of course, there are places like SeaWorld that have been under heavy criticism lately. Do you think there is a place for some of these animals to be in captivity so we can learn more about them and see them perform and see the ET here on Earth? Or do you think that there are way too many of them in captivity and many should be taught how to live in the oceans again, or all of them should be? What do you think? We'd love to hear from you, and we'll take your calls for Tim in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Farmers Union. Registration is open for WFU Camp Kenwood on Lake Wissota near Chippewa Falls. Developing young leaders through cooperation, education, and fun. CampKenwood.com. Support also comes from Kopke's Greenhouse near Oregon, growers of bedding plants and baskets, serving southern Wisconsin gardeners for 32 years. More online at kopkesgreenhouse.com, where inspiration grows.
Hour two of our program this Thursday, it started with their award-winning profile of Fred Astaire back in 1980. Joan Kramer and David Healy have documented the lives and careers of many Hollywood legends, and they have done beautiful work. They have talked, done interviews, not always some of the people would not consent to being on camera to be talked to, but they talked to people who knew them and worked with them. So among the many luminaries they have highlighted, Errol Flynn, James Stewart, Paul Newman, and Joanne Woodward, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Fred Astaire, Henry Fonda, Jane Fonda, and many others. They have interesting stories to tell, and they'll be with us hour two. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Beatrice in Madison is calling in. Hi, Beatrice.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two things I wanted to say. One is to tell about a wonderful dolphin encounter I had. I used to be a professional diver, and I worked for a dive shop in Puerto Rico. And at the end of the dive where we'd been taking clients around, I went down to get the anchor because we always like to pick it up rather than drag it across the sand or hit coral or something. So I had picked up the anchor. It was on its way up to the boat when suddenly this dolphin appeared. I was in about 15 feet of water. The dolphin swam around me in circles. And, of course, I just kept reaching out my hand, hoping I could touch it. But it was playing a game with me. It stayed inches away from my fingertips. Never let me touch it. And just went around and around and around me in circles. And, of course, they have this wonderful mouth that curls up at this corner, so it looks as though it was smiling at me the whole time. There I stayed, and I finally had to go out up because I was out of air. And the captain of the boat by that time was getting quite worried. But boy, oh boy, that was so exciting, and I've never got over it.
Well, I'm glad that we were doing this show so we could hear all about it. Boy, oh boy, I'll bet that was exciting. Tim, we do have a fascination of wanting to be with these animals, some of us.
We do, absolutely, because they're so intelligent and charismatic. What I like about that story is it just shows what can happen when you see the dolphin in its natural environment. And obviously, you can't always know if you're going to see a dolphin if you're scuba diving or snorkeling or underwater. But if you spend enough time on the water, you will see dolphins. And there's just something special about encountering dolphins in a natural way like that, that I think really does touch people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's understandable that they're so moved by them.
What do you think in terms of finding breakthroughs in the next 5 years or 10 years concerning their language, concerning who these creatures really are, because they are so different than us in so many ways? Do you think we're going to learn a whole lot more about them, Tim?
I think we will. And actually, you know, I've done a lot of work as well on dolphin intelligence and what we know about them. And most researchers you speak with will tell you that, you know, one thing we know about dolphin intelligence is we really know very little about it. And I do think you were discussing this with Joshua a little bit in terms of the language and how alien it is. And I think that we just don't yet understand how their brains work and what kind of intelligence they have. But I think that as we do learn that, say, over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, I think whatever we discover will be vastly exceed what we assume the intelligence to be and will be surprising in many, many interesting ways. Every researcher who works with dolphins, that's the first thing they tell you is just how unbelievably quick and intelligent dolphins appear to be.
So our extraterrestrials might be right in our oceans, huh?
Well, that's the idea, and that's why Denise Herzing is doing the work she does. It's instead of looking to outer space, there's an alien species right here that hopefully we can communicate with or at least have encounters with on a regular basis.
Thank you, Beatrice, so much for that great story. Justin in Fountain City, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question regarding the language and how complex it is, and also the complex social networks. do these dolphins that are being reintegrated into the wild, do they have difficulty fitting in or understanding other dolphins?
The answer is we don't really know. What's very interesting is different dolphins will do better in the wild than others. So the turkey dolphins were both males. And most people think that females are more adaptable and better able to reintegrate themselves into wild groups. Tom and Misha, after they were released in Turkey, spent a lot of their time alone. They seemed to do fine. They hunted for fish. They stayed healthy. But they didn't necessarily join one big social group or find whatever social group they originally came from. And that's a challenge because you don't really know how they're going to do. Keiko, the whale that was released, the killer whale that was released in Iceland, never reintegrated with any kind of wild killer whale group, and that was a big problem for him, and eventually he died of pneumonia. The Korea dolphins were very interesting also. They were a mix of male and female, but they came from a group of dolphins that are resident off an island called Jeju in South Korea. So as soon as they were released, they reappeared within a matter of days, often, in this group of 120 dolphins from which they had originally been taken. And you can imagine that returning to your family group like that probably makes your reintegration a lot easier. And I also like to amuse myself thinking what the other dolphins thought when suddenly three dolphins who had disappeared for 4 years reappeared with
right.
kind of strange markings. And it's like an alien abduction. And they'll be like, hey, Joe, where you been, dude? Oh, man, it was crazy. There was lights. There was music. How the dolphins will do in the wild does depend somewhat on the situation that they came from and how much is known about the situation. And Jeff Foster and Born Free knew very little about where Tom and Misha came from and their social groups, but they took a chance. And as it turned out, we know that they survived for at least 6 months, and hopefully they're still out there somewhere doing well.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call, Justin. Let's go to Ann in Sheboygan. Hi, Ann.
Hello.
Ann. Hi, Ann. Turn the radio down, please.
Okay, there we go.
Okay, go ahead.
So my question is, how much money and time does it take to rehabilitate them back to the wild?
Takes a lot of money, doesn't it?
That's a great question, and I think that's the single greatest problem, apart from the fact that not many dolphins come available to reintegrate into the wild. So it turned out, partly because Tom and Misha in Turkey, they got sick, and partly because, you know, it was such a rush when they were first taken by Born Free and brought to a sea pen. It ended up costing about $1 million. And a big part of that cost, in addition to just staff and people's time, which you don't really think of, is getting live fish to teach them how to fish and hunt for wild fish again. If you think about, you know, you can go to fish markets, but all those fish are dead. And so actually, I mean, accumulating live fish can be a costly exercise. And just a budget line item for providing enough fish for dolphins is quite substantial. Interestingly, and so Tom and Misha took almost a year and a half to be released because of the various problems that they had. Interestingly, the Korea dolphins were released within months. So it was super fast and it was very easy to do. But ironically, it ended up costing almost the same amount because there are such strict regulations in South Korea about using fish farms that when they took a couple of fish farms out of the fish farming circulation to use for the dolphins, they had to pay, I think, $600,000 to the fishing co-op for the use of the pens. And so until the price can be brought way down and there are people working on portable and less expensive pens that can be used, releasing dolphins is very expensive, and that'll be a big challenge if more dolphins become available.
Are there a lot of dolphins in the world, Tim?
Yeah, there are about 3,000 captive dolphins estimated, and there are about 500 in the U.S. And another big difference is whether they were caught in the wild or they were born in captivity. So when you think of SeaWorld and most of the dolphins they have are now by now have been born in captivity. And you can imagine it might be very difficult to take a dolphin that was born in captivity and try to teach it how to live wild in the ocean. That's probably not possible. But about a third of the dolphins worldwide, the 3,000 or so that are in captivity in marine parks, have been caught from the wild. And so they could all potentially be candidates for release if public sentiment about marine parks and dolphin captivity changes enough that dolphin parks are starting to look for ways to return their dolphins to the oceans.
And what about the number of dolphins not in captivity, the number in the ocean? Do we know?
I have no idea what the number in the ocean is, but they are present in every ocean in the world. And they're not endangered in any way, so I think they're very populous throughout the world's oceans. And so it's really just an issue of, you know, where what populations you're talking about and where you are. There are some local threats to different dolphin populations and different killer whale populations, but on the whole, dolphins and killer whales are very, very well adapted to their environment and seem to be very durable despite all the changes in the oceans that are going on.
And the movement to get them released from these places where they're being held in captivity is growing, is it?
I would say sentiments about dolphin captivity and marine mammal captivity are changing. We've seen a lot of change and a lot of pressure on SeaWorld since Blackfish. But SeaWorld is engaged in a pretty big public relations effort to turn that around, and we'll see really what happens. SeaWorld itself has said that they think that in the United States and Europe, for example, the future for marine parks and marine mammal captivity is not so bright because public sentiments are changing. But there are other parts of the world, especially Asia, the Middle East, and Russia, where publics, you know, they want to see dolphins, and they're perfectly happy to see them in captivity. So that's really where the future for that market lies and potentially where SeaWorld and other marine park enterprises would turn to if marine mammal captivity in the U.S. and Europe really does come to an end.
Tim, thank you ever so much for being with us. It's so fascinating, aren't they? It's just fascinating to me.
Always happy to talk dolphins and killer whales. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we'll talk to you again about dolphins and killer whales. Tim is author of the June feature story we have yet to see, but we have an advanced copy. It's Born to be Wild, and he's written quite a bit about the captive dolphin and killer whale industry. He's associate producer and co-writer of the documentary film, which you might be interested in seeing after listening to this, Blackfish, and former senior editor, diplomatic correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this very interesting hour, and thanks to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and join us for the next hour where you're going to hear some fascinating stories about people who were featured in documentaries, Hollywood luminaries.